Hello, my name's Jack Luna, and I'm the host of Dark Topic, a true crime podcast dedicated to a deep dive and an honest interpretation of history's most heinous cases. Since 2017, I've been creeping around the true crime podcasting sphere, but it is here, with Dark Topic, that I feel most at home. Come collect bones at Fox Hollow Farm. Pick through the wreckage of the demented farmer of Bass, explosive temper. Mull over Baraboo, Wisconsin's disturbing leg thing case with me, one of the most fascinating stories never told. Dark Topic has a way of making the familiar completely strange again. One-on-one, every episode presented without borders. Subscribe to Dark Topic and prepare to have your eyes cocked, those doors locked, and to stay paranoid.
All right, welcome everyone back to Foul Play. I'm joined with Gemma. Gemma, it's been a long time. Do you know how long it's been?
I don't know. Have we done one on the last? We did one with Ronnie Norpell.
Yeah.
And we did one about the bankruptcy, but that's been last winter, maybe?
Yeah, it was just as the bankruptcy from the Archdiocese started.
So that was a year ago then.
Well, Gemma, we planned to record today. I went to go look at a couple things, and I realized, and I don't know if you thought about this, this is completely unplanned, but did you know that today was Kathy's birthday?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. She would have been 82 years old.
Jeez, I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it.
And
today is November 17th. Wow.
Yeah. And of course, she was, you know.
Oh, my God.
She was murdered 10 days before her 27th birthday.
Right. Oh, my goodness. That kind of gives me chills.
It gave me chills when I saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess this was meant to be then.
I guess so.
Yep.
All right.
Let's do this thing.
All right. So, Gemma, as I said, I've compiled all the questions that we've been sent in, which is a lot of questions, but I've tried to put them in some type of order for us. So I will just go ahead and get started. And of course, if you have any input, you are welcome to input.
Well, I have actually have a question for you, Shane.
Yeah.
Would many of the questions be answered if we do a timeline of the weeks leading up to Kathy and the weekend she disappeared?
Yeah.
Because we have documentation and eyewitnesses, but I don't want to monopolize. I just thought it might take care of some of the questions.
Yeah, go for it.
Do you want me to take 5 minutes and do that?
Yeah.
Okay, wave at me if I'm getting too wordy.
Okay.
So I'm going to suggest, everybody, that you get a pencil and some paper. I know that most people are not audio learners or learning by listening. So you might want to jot this down. The information I'm going to give you is either documented on paper by a document, or the person it happened to is the one that gave us the information. Okay. So I'm going to do this part real quick. Kathy left Keough in June of 1969. She spent the summer going to classes, and in July, she and her friend, Sister Russell Phillips, moved into an apartment in the area of Baltimore County, or Baltimore, called Catonsville. And they moved to the Carriage House Apartments, and that was the last place she lived. So they moved in July. She started teaching at the end of August at Western High School, which was a school for girls, but it was a public high school. Now, in The Keepers, it's a little misleading. This is just an editing issue, but people think that she was at Keough the last day that she taught, because you can see the girls in uniforms, and it looks like the Keough uniform and that's not the same. I don't even think the girls at Western wore uniforms. So just to make a clarification, because it's come up before. Okay, so she starts teaching in August. None of the girls knew she was a nun. Some of them kind of figured it out, because there's something about a nun in street clothes that kind of doesn't work. And a lot of the clothes had been given to her by other people, because she and Russ didn't have much money. So there's a beautiful picture of her standing in front of a chalkboard with a lot of notes on it in her handwriting. And that's actually been really helpful, because it gave everybody an example of what her handwriting looks like. So I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So that brings us up to the end of October, beginning of November. Several girls who had been close to her when she was at Keio came to visit her at the apartment. And the first one I'm going to mention was Kathy Hoback. Kathy Hoback is in The Keepers. She's the woman who, as a girl, played the guitar and was with Kathy in her classroom after school. And Maskell called her to the office, and Kathy covered for her and told him over the speaker that she wasn't available because she had work to do. So that was Kathy Hoback. And she went to see Kathy a couple weeks before she disappeared. And she went with another friend, another female friend, a student. And when they went to the apartment, Kathy Hoback told me that they just made small talk, because Kathy Sesnick knew that Kathy had been abused, but the friend did not. So in order to keep that private, neither Kathy Hoback nor Sister Kathy brought it up. But Kathy did see her, and she said she didn't really notice anything different. Then we have Chris Constantine Santafonte, who was also in The Keepers, and she is the woman who turned out to be Russell and John Welch's real estate agent when they got married and moved to Carroll County. And Chris went to see Kathy, I think, the week before she disappeared. If Chris is listening, she can correct us. And was excited because she wanted to tell Kathy about her boyfriend. But she also was very sad because her mom was either really ill or had just passed away. So we know that Chris was there. And what Chris told me was that Kathy seemed different. She seemed subdued. So I believe this was like the week before she disappeared. So that brings us to Monday, November 3rd, 1969. On Monday, November 3rd is a letter, a handwritten letter, that Kathy supposedly wrote to Jerry Koo. Now, the original letter is in the morgue notes at the medical examiner's office, or it was. I have seen the original. Can't share how or why. The original letter is not typed. It's handwritten. And in 1992, journalist Bob Erlandson was permitted to go to the ME's office, medical examiner, and look at that letter. And he told me that they would not give him a copy of it, like a Xerox copy, but they told him he could be allowed to hand copy it on his own paper. So Bob took a legal pad with him, which is like 8.5 by 17 or something. It's a much bigger piece of paper. And he hand copied the letter that Kathy wrote in his own handwriting. And it is 4 legal size pages long. It's very long. The whole thing has not been published, and it's not going to be published because some of it's very private. But Kathy supposedly started this letter at 12:30 a.m. on Monday, November 3rd. Now, Kathy had to go to school and get up like at 6 o'clock. Because I've seen the letter, a letter like this would take over an hour to write, maybe 2 hours, because it's so lengthy and there's a lot in it. knowing her, she is not the kind of person that would stay up into the morning hours writing a letter if she had to get up and go to school. That's an opinion, but it's an opinion that a lot of people agree with. Now, supposedly or allegedly, the letter was mailed to Coop, and he claims he received it on Wednesday, November 5th. Okay. He would not do a podcast, but I've talked to him about this letter, and he claims it was typed. So in the Keepers, you see a woman typing, but the first few lines of the letter say, "I'm curled up in bed." I don't know anybody who would have a typewriter. Nobody had a laptop in 1969 in their bed typing. That's kind of impossible because a typewriter is not like a laptop. You can't just like touch the keys. You got to press on them. So big issue there with the letter. When I told him I had seen the original and that it was not typed, he said, "Well, that bewilders me too." So I had been given small snapshots of parts of the letter. For example, the date, the salutation, the closing, so that I could see different parts of it, but not the whole thing. I sent him those little pictures. I was a little nervous about doing it, but I did. And there were about five of them. And he said, "I don't understand this." Now, I know this is a timeline, but this is important too. Shane, wave at me if you want me to stop. But I had a friend who is a profiler. And the friend, the expertise is in the area of the content of documents, not the handwriting. So I sent the friend, I took Bob's copy of the letter, the 4-page one, and I typed it on my computer in a large font, exactly the way he wrote it, with his commas, quotation marks, parentheses, everything, format, and I left space in between, and I sent it to my profiler friend. 2 weeks later, my profiler calls me, we go through the letter, and the profiler says, "I don't believe Kathy wrote this. I think that Coop wrote this." Those are my thoughts from the beginning. And this person does not know him. This person saw the Keepers, but both of us thought there were parts of the letter that were not at all the way Kathy would speak. For example, the profiler asked me if Kathy would put the date on the upper right-hand corner or the upper left-hand corner. And Kathy was an English teacher, and she taught us letter writing. And in letter writing, a friendly letter, a love letter, you put the date in the upper right-hand corner. That's not where it is. That's not typical of Kathy. There's also a PS at the end that says, "I can't wait to see you this weekend," meaning the weekend she disappeared. Then it says, "But with my luck, Russell will be here." So first of all, if Kathy didn't write it, the PS confirms that the person who did write it is establishing that they had a date for the weekend and that Kathy is ruminating over the fact that her best friend is going to be there. That's not Kathy. She would never, ever, ever do that. Okay. The other thing in the letter that I just discovered, I said to Coop when we went to the carriage house, "How many times were you up here?" And he said, "The only time I was at the carriage house was when I came up the night Kathy disappeared." And I was surprised at that. And I read the letter again last week, and it says, the person writing the letter says something about the last time you were here. Oops. So whoever wrote this letter is establishing that the Coop was there other than just that one time. The other thing is, if he was only there one time and Russ called him at Manresa, how the heck would he know where to go? There was no GPS. It's not a direct shot up from Annapolis. So that takes us to the middle of the week, the 5th. And Coob told me that he talked to Kathy on the phone on Wednesday, the 5th. Shane, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what you remember too, right? Okay. And that they plan to get together on Saturday. So my thought is that the whole week was a setup, establishing these dates in writing and on the phone, and all this is coming from him. I asked him where the letter came from, and he said he gave it to the police when they came to question him. He put it in a folder with other writings of Kathy's and gave them the whole folder. So there's no envelope, no stamp. Now, we're not talking about the letter that Kathy supposedly sent her sister. This is totally different. So he said he put it in a folder, gave it to the police, never saw it again. But it ended up in the morgue notes, and that's where Bob was allowed to copy it. So that brings us to Thursday night. That would be November 6th. On Thursday night, a young woman, a student of Kathy's, not from Western, but from Keough, went to see Kathy and Russ with her boyfriend in the evening. Shortly after they went in, Kathy and Russ had them sit down. Russ asked if they wanted something to drink. She went to the kitchen, which was just adjacent to the living area, and started to get, you know, some glasses out. And shortly after they arrived, Joseph Maskell and Neil Magnus came into the apartment. Now, everybody makes a big deal saying they burst into the apartment. They, you know, loudly, they walked in without knocking. That's what the movies, that's what we know. They walked in without knocking. So 2 years ago, I went over to Carriage House with a friend, and we found a spot across the street where we parked the car. We had a perfect line of sight to the doors. And if we were sitting there waiting to see if somebody, we were stalking Kathy's apartment, we couldn't be seen. We could have seen that woman and her boyfriend go in there, and we could have gone in shortly after. So my gut's telling me that the apartment was being watched, that the whole week was choreographed to end the way it did. So the young woman and her boyfriend, Kathy, told them to leave. We don't know what happened after that. But again, the priest did not barge in. They did not slam in. They opened the door and came in without knocking. Now, just as an example, I thought that was odd, but my neighbor walks my dog, right? She knows I'm doing this podcast right now. She's just going to quietly open the front door, get the dog, and go. Some people just have their door unlocked. So I don't know if this was a common occurrence. I have a feeling the priest visited Kathy more than once. We don't know what transpired that night. But we know the next morning, everybody went to school. So we don't know what the priest said that night to the nuns. The young woman was at Keough, but remember, Kathy was not there. Kathy was teaching at Western. Russ was teaching at North Bend Junior High, which was right next door to the apartments. So they shared a car, and Russ would walk to school. So the young girl, Maskell pulled her out before school started, told her, if you tell anybody about last night, I will kill you and your family and your boyfriend. She had nowhere to go. There's nobody in that building now that she could even talk to. Can you imagine being in that position? I'm not going to say her name. I've never, ever repeated her name. She prefers to be anonymous. If she wants to out herself, that's up to her, but I'm not going to do it. So that takes us to Friday morning. Friday morning, everybody went to school. So everybody must have been okay. Friday afternoon, I believe around 1:30 or 2 o'clock, our friend from the Keepers, Juliana Bartaldi, was in Kathy's class. At the end of the class, she was talking to Kathy before she moved on, and Kathy told her that she was going to go out that night and look for a gift for her sister, who was getting married. And I don't know if you all know this, but she actually invited Juliana to go with her. And Juliana, you know, it wasn't weird to do things with your teachers back then. I mean, I had kids and parents come to my house at times, right? So this was kind of different. It wasn't creepy like it is now. But Juliana said to Kathy, well, I live on the other side of the city. I don't have a car. I have to, you know, get home. I have to fix dinner for my family. But with Kathy inviting Juliana, and Juliana told me this happened, that tells me that Kathy had no idea what was going to happen that night. She wasn't going to meet somebody. She wasn't going to go somewhere dangerous because she would never, ever in a million years put one of her students in danger. And she was actually willing to go get Juliana on the other side of the city. So that didn't happen, but it's a good timeline point, like a timestamp point, to know that Kathy had no idea what was coming. Okay. Jane, do you have any comments or questions so far?
No, not yet.
Okay. I'm getting to the end. I just want everybody to have like a good timeline because these questions keep coming up. Okay, so Kathy goes home, and it was payday. At 5 o'clock, another friend, her name is Sharon Hamill Bush, she stopped in to see the nuns. Now, Sharon and her mom had given Kathy and Russ some clothes, and Sharon says she can't remember if she was picking up clothes or dropping them off. But Sharon was a year ahead of me at Keough, and Russell was one of her best friends. And again, this wasn't strange. Sharon would have been 18 or 19, and Russ would have been like 25 or 26, and they were buddies. So it wasn't odd for Sharon to be over there. She said she was there around 5. She dropped off whatever it was she had or picked up. She went home and had dinner with her own family. The nuns ate around 5:30, and the medical examiner was able to identify from Kathy's remains, even after being out in the elements, what she had had for dinner. She had ham and sweet potatoes, I think, and a salad. And so we know they had dinner. We think that Kathy decided to go out to Edmondson Village at about 7:30.
As fall rolls in, I'm ready to trade in summer gear for cozy layers. And there's no better way to elevate my wardrobe than with a few essentials from Quince. Imagine slipping into a soft Mongolian cashmere sweater that starts at just $60, or putting on a sharp leather jacket, all without breaking the bank. Quince focuses on luxury quality without the luxury price tag. How? By working directly with ethical factories, Quince skips the middleman, so their pieces cost 50 to 80% less than similar brands. That means I can upgrade my style with premium fabrics and finishes for a fraction of the price. Upgrade your wardrobe with pieces made to last. Go to quince.com/Shane for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/Shane to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/Shane.
This time has like gone back and forth a few times, but our friend Mary Spence you guys probably can't figure out how I have all this in my head, right? I mean, I've been living with it for 10 years. But Mary Spence, she and her husband took the route that we believe Kathy took to the bank and to Edmonton Village and back home again to see if it could be done in an hour. They did it, but there wasn't much time to spare. So we actually think that Kathy took a different route than what was outlined in the Keepers. We think that when she came out of her parking lot, instead of going right to go up to Edmonton Avenue, she turned left to go down to Frederick Road. She turned right on Frederick Road, and there was a Muley's on Frederick Road. She may never have gone into the Hep Company Muley's. Nobody saw her there, but they had a bakery on Frederick Road. It would have been on the right-hand side. She would have been passing it. So it makes sense that that's probably where she bought the rolls for breakfast. She would go a little bit farther, maybe another mile up, and there's the bank. Okay? So she did not have a drive-through. She would have had to park, stop, and go in. She had both Russell's check and hers. She cashed the checks. A lot of people want to know how they went to a bank at night. The banks were open on Friday nights. I don't know about where you guys live, but they were open on Friday nights. She cashed the check. She continued to the corner to Edmonton Avenue. I wish that you could all look at this on a map, but I can paste one or post one on the pages and you can take a look at it. She made a right-hand turn onto Edmonton Avenue. She could have driven straight to Edmonton Village. Maybe she never went in the Hep Company. We know she went to Hoshel Cone on the left side of the highway because a young girl whose mom or whose aunt was a teacher at Keough, they spoke to her in the parking lot at a store called Hoshel Cone. That may be where she was looking for a gift. She may not have gone across the street to the Hep Company at all. But if she didn't find something, we know that she could have driven across the highway down, forget the name of the street, but she could have come out on Frederick Road again near Mount St. Joe, turned right, and within a couple of minutes would have been back at her apartment. So it's a different route. It's a shorter route. It's a more direct route. We're going to talk about the necklace a little bit later in your questions, but just so you know, the necklace is a non-issue now. So she came back around 8:30. We know that a woman who lived in the apartment, she was not an airline stewardess, is what they were called. She worked at the airport, okay? And Russ said that she saw Kathy, somebody followed Kathy, or Kathy followed somebody out of the parking lot. Okay, that brings us to when was the car seen again? The car was seen by people in the neighborhood as early as 11 o'clock. The police talked to some of the folks that lived in the court where the car was found. And where the car was found, where you saw the car in the Keepers, that's not actually where it was found. It was found another court up the street, which would not have been visible from Kathy's apartment. So it was actually found on Carriage Court, not Lantern Court, which is what you saw Coob talking to Abby and me at the car. That's not where it was found. Okay. That brings us to a phone call. At 10 o'clock that night, Russell called Sharon Bush, who had been at their apartment at 5 o'clock, to see if Sharon knew where Kathy was. Sharon didn't know where Kathy was. At 10 minutes after 10, Russell called Jerry Coob. Now, Coop says he and Pete had gone to the movies and were back in Coop's office having Tia Maria, which is a liqueur. But I can't figure out how she made that call, because I think there was a switchboard and I don't think he had a direct line. So that's a little confusing. I might be wrong, but that's a big question mark. He said he and Pete got in the car, said they were up at Carriage House by 10:50. That's driving really fast from Annapolis, really fast. So he said at 10:50, they got there. Now, what he told me is different than what's in the missing person report. He said Russell told them that Kathy had gone out and that they called the police at 11:30, which makes sense, rather than sitting around talking about it for 2 hours and calling at 1:30. So the missing person report is way different than what Coop says happened, okay? The missing person report said two police officers arrived, and it gives their names. They've written a report. And all this is in the, not to push my book, because I don't know if you're even going to be able to get a copy, but all this is in the back of the book, the missing person report. He says that one officer came. Missing person report says two. Guess what? They're both dead. I couldn't find them. So he said they gave him the information and he left and they sat around. And he says at 3:30 or so, they went out. He and Pete went out for a walk in the neighborhood, which to me, if I were a 25-year-old woman and my roommate just disappeared, I wouldn't let them leave me. I'd be terrified. I wouldn't let them leave me in that apartment. I also asked if any of them drove the route back and forth between the apartment and Edmondson Village. Guess what his answer was? I don't remember. So he remembers Tia Maria, but he doesn't remember if they drove back and forth. That is huge. You would remember that if that was your special person, okay? Sarah Lee, around 3:30, missing person report says Pete found the car and took something out of the back seat. Coop says that's not true, that he and Pete found the car together. So I talked to Sharon not long ago. She said that Russell did tell her that early in the morning, like Saturday morning, Coop did say mass in the apartment, like at 6 o'clock in the morning. Okay. So that morning, all hell breaks loose, but the car is already gone. And it was towed to the southwest area in Baltimore City, where they put cars to examine them. But it was towed nose up or tail up. It should have been moved on a flatbed, but at that time it was considered a missing person, not a homicide. And I've talked to police officers who said still it should have been covered in plastic. The inside should have had plastic in it so that no evidence would be moved, and it would be moved on a flatbed truck, and it wasn't. So that brings us to Saturday. I have a friend who lived upstairs from Sister Kathy. You guys see what Shane and I have been doing for the last 6 or 7 years, right? She told me that she never heard anything, but that she heard from a neighbor that Kathy had disappeared. She made some food, as people always take food over, right? She went over to the apartment in the afternoon, and that Russ and Coop were sitting in the living room. She doesn't remember if another man was there, so we don't know if Pete was there or not. And she said they just looked sad, so she gave them the food and left. So that brings us to Saturday afternoon. By the end of Saturday, there were 35 police cars in that neighborhood. And you've all seen that picture. The whole weekend, there are police cars everywhere. Now, my question is, why would that many Baltimore City and County police cars show up for a 26-year-old female who didn't leave a husband and children? Maybe she took a vacation. My gut tells me, just from what I've heard, that a lot of those police officers may have been involved in the abuse and wanted to know what was going on and who knew what. There's no reason for there to be that many officers. So that takes care of the weekend that Kathy disappeared. I know I went on forever, but I try to timestamp and earmark information that you guys have been asking about. I leave anything out, Shane?
The only thing that I would add or emphasize is that when we spoke to Sharon on the podcast, she had also mentioned her conversation with Russ and the man or the police officer detective in the trench coat. So what Sharon told us was that when she came into the apartment the next morning after Kathy had disappeared, that she was talking to Russ and Russ told her, you know, to tell the police whatever she knows. And the man in the trench coat, the detective, came up to her and asked her if there was anyone at Keough who did anything to her that she didn't want them to do.
And Mr. Trenchcoat has been identified. His daughter got in touch with me. She said, that's my father. And she said she talked to him. He's very old. And I don't know that he had all his faculties together, but he couldn't remember anything about it. So, but she said she knows he's the one that was there that day. And I even forget the last name. So we're never going to know. Sharon said all she could remember was that some boy tried to kiss her in the hallway at one of the sock hops. Those were the dances we had in the gym because you couldn't wear regular shoes in the gym. So they called them a sock hop because you had to take your shoes off. So weird. But anyway, she said that's the only thing she could think of. So she told me that Russ and Koo were both standing there with the officer. And I asked him about that. He said he has no memory of that.
I think one of the things that makes it significant in my mind is that, one, Kathy was not teaching at Keough. So why would the police officer or the detective ask her that question?
Exactly.
But it also tells us that since Russell was standing right there, that it at least alludes that she was aware of something, some abuse of some kind.
Right. And would have told the police that.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks Russ was in on this. She did not ever do anything nefarious. She's standing there while the cop is asking Sharon if anybody ever asked her to do something she didn't want to do. So that tells us that Russell had told the police what was going on.
Right.
Okay. So I apologize if I talked too long, but those are things that people wanted the times for. So I think that's a pretty... not concise, but that's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah. So you had also mentioned that Kathy's car wasn't found right across from her carriage house apartment.
Correct.
Was it found in an area that you could still see it from the apartment, or how far away was it?
No. There's a bend in the road. You've been there, right?
Yeah.
You're there with me. Right. Okay. So where we were told it was found by Koo was directly across from her driveway. It was found up the street around a bend in the next court. And I think the confusion was because the court across the street was called Lantern Court, and the court where it was found was called Carriage Court, and her address was Carriage House. So I think that's where the confusion is, but it was not found where he indicated it was found. It was found up the block and around a big bend. And I talked to a guy who used to live in the apartment. He worked night shift for the police or for, what do you call the people that work in jails? I don't know. Anyway, that part of the law enforcement. He said he was coming home in the morning and he saw the car, parked oddly at carriage court. And he couldn't, he said it looked to him the way a car would be pulled over if somebody was pulling them over, like if a police officer was pulling them over.
Yeah. It's, you know, all very bizarre that if that's where the car was found, that Coob wouldn't have remembered that, that he would think that it was right outside the apartment. I guess what's really odd to me about Coob's memory of events is some things he is very specific about. And then the other things, he either gets it wrong or he'll say he just doesn't remember. So it's just weird to me, I guess. But, you know, we're looking back at it from 2024 now. So it's, you know, all just bizarre, I guess. So, Gemma, let's go ahead and get into our questions. We have a lot of them. So let's first start at Kathy's car, as we were just talking about. This question asks, whose DNA was found on the cigarette in Sister Kathy's car, and were there fingerprints detected on the steering wheel?
Okay. The answer is nobody's DNA and no fingerprints. So the cigarette was not found on the ground near her body. The cigarette is clearly seen in a picture on the floor of the back seat. That cigarette was taken into evidence, and it matched nobody's DNA. Now, that was done more recently because DNA was not collected in 1969. It was just the beginning of DNA. But as of right now, I believe the police have Edgar's DNA, Billy Schmidt's DNA, Ron Schmidt's DNA, Maskell's DNA. Don't know about Magnus. I don't know if they have Coob's DNA. That's probably an interesting question that we could find out, but he's not going to talk to anybody. So it did not match anything. I kind of, you know, I think I'm Nancy Drew. I thought it was what's called a red herring. Like somebody just picked it up out of the trash and threw it in the back seat just to send everybody in a different direction. The other question you asked was about, what was the other question?
Were there fingerprints on the steering wheel?
Oh, no. And you know what? The car was processed as a missing person car, but strangely, zero fingerprints. Now, we know that both Baltimore City and Baltimore County Police were involved in the abuse. We don't know who was in charge of that investigation, but it was really botched. And we know that Maskell's half-brother, Tommy Maskell, was a high-ranking officer in another part of the city. And who knows what, you know, what was done to the car that could have been done differently, but no fingerprints.
I think it was also significant that you just mentioned a minute ago about how the car was towed, that they towed it either front end up or back end up.
And correct.
And so because they had done that and they didn't use a flatbed, you know, so we've seen pictures from the inside of the car, and I guess I had always assumed that her trash can was kicked over during some incident. But because the car was towed like that, I mean, the trash can would have moved.
Yeah.
And then there's also the... And maybe the cigarette butt came out of the trash can and just fell into the back, you know. Unfortunately, because they botched that part, I guess we will just never know what scenario could have played out.
And the other thing is that car was returned pretty quickly to Russell. As I said, they shared the car. It was not kept as evidence in a homicide because they didn't know for 2 months if it was a homicide. So the car was returned to her, and we've tried to track the car. This is really strange. I had to pay a private investigator to do this. The year that the vehicle identification numbers started was 1971. So there was no vehicle ID number on that car. We have no idea what happened to it after Russ drove it.
Yeah, that is very bizarre.
Yeah.
I imagine that she probably didn't have it very long afterwards, because I wouldn't, you know, if she was so freaked out, I don't know that she'd be comfortable driving it, I guess.
Don't know.
All right, so our next question is, was any significant information obtained from Joyce Malecki's body?
Okay. As some of you know, Joyce Malecki's body was exhumed a little over a year ago, September of 2023, and a full DNA profile was done in the hopes that someone else's DNA would be on Joyce's body. Now, I went on national television with that lady, Elizabeth Vargas. I don't even know what show that was. But she asked me what I thought about that, and I said I thought it was a smoke screening, and then they got me off the air real quick. because I think that the police were trying to make it look like they were doing something. But I've talked to two funeral directors, and they told me, first of all, she was not buried in the clothes that she was found in, okay? And she was cleaned, exhumed, which means your body fluids are taken out and other fluids are put in. And she was prepared for burial. There's no way. They said there's like part of 1% that somebody else's DNA was on her body. Now, the police did take nail clippings because there was organic material under her fingernails. And there were fingerprints. But all we know is that the fingerprints ended up in a binder someplace in New York. And the fingernail clippings were destroyed. And we were told that after 25 years, as long as those things had been documented, they can be destroyed or get rid of them. I never heard that before. But anyway, so the Malecki's right now have gotten no information. They did not take Joyce to the medical examiner's office. They exhumed her body in the cemetery. They took her on a gurney into not the chapel, but like a work building over there. The medical examiner came, did the DNA profile, and within a half hour, she was buried again and her gravesite was, you know, repaired. Her brother arrived right around the time they were finishing up. But I talked to the Malecki's, and as of not long ago, they heard nothing. So I don't know if they ever will. And now we have a new administration coming. So it's going to be real tricky to even get the FBI, who handled this case, to do anything about her case. Now, we had help from Senator Van Hollen's office and Barbara Mikulski's office, and even they couldn't get any information for us. So I think the FBI is hiding something.
Yeah, it's always been really bizarre that the FBI even destroyed her evidence in the first place.
Right. 4,000 pages of documents, Shane, 4,000, and the family's been given none of it. They don't even have her autopsy. That's wrong.
Right. Yeah. And also you mentioned how it would be difficult to get DNA off of her body now, but she was also found in water.
Right.
So that would have also hurt their chances to get any type of DNA. So any type of organic material found under her fingerprints could have likely been as a result of the water and the, the dirt and everything that would be right there.
Yep.
All right, so the next question is, has any DNA from Kathy or Joyce ever been analyzed using advanced forensic methods like those at Othram Labs?
Great question. Gemma has the answer. Okay, I talked to the guy that runs Othram. Those of you that don't know it, they solve more cold cases than any lab in the country. Shane, you've been there, right?
Yeah, I went earlier this year. It's in Houston.
Yep. Yeah. So our friend Tracy on the West Coast put me in touch with them, and they offered to, at no cost to anybody, analyze any DNA. And they made an overture to the Baltimore County Police Department, who has handled this case, and they were told no. Don't ask me why. There is DNA from Kathy's clothing that was taken probably 6 years ago out to Utah where the Utah Bureau of Investigation analyzed it at that time with, now I forget what the name of it is, the little vacuum cleaner thing.
The MVAC.
MVAC, that's it. That picks up more DNA than anything can. And it takes fluids and everything, and then it dehydrates it, and what's left is usable DNA. So Detective Gary Childs, also from the Keepers, did that. He carried it on a plane, came back and retired, but he's not in the picture anymore, and we never heard much about it. Then I heard from Captain Robin Teal that there was no male DNA found on her clothing. Which doesn't surprise me because, and this is one of the questions that you have in your stack there, Shane. Somebody asked what she was wearing. Kathy had on the clothes she wore to school. She had on a navy skirt, a jacket, a yellow sweater, and a raincoat, low heels, and gloves. And so there was a lot of clothing. They took it all out there, and they used the MVAC thing. And Robin told me there was no male DNA, but Kathy worked in a girls' high school. And I don't know if there were many male teachers there, but if there's touch DNA, it could have been, you know, brushing against somebody in the building because it was all females. I don't know. I asked about a week ago. Josh Battaglia is the police officer who is handling the case. He said the DNA is still on hold. I don't get it. And what he said to me is that the longer you can wait before using up the DNA, the better, because technology is improving every day. And once you use the DNA, you can't use it again. Is that your understanding of how it works, Shane?
Yeah, so if they have a small amount, they have to have a minimum amount in order for them to extract a DNA profile. And so if they have to use that amount, it's possible that they will destroy it. So for example, if they send Othram Labs some particles that they were able to collect from Joyce, for example, Othram would take it and look to see how much of a DNA profile they might be able to extract, but they will also let them know that they would destroy any chance in the future if they try to do it. So normally those scientists are very careful and they would rather prioritize the profile at a later time when they may not destroy further testing. So those scientists really have a good understanding of the capabilities of the technology.
So is that what you're saying is that the longer you wait, the less DNA you need to get a profile because of the way technology is moving so quickly?
Yeah, those scientists continually find new methods, create better technology and all those things. So combining all of that, yes, with time, it's clear that we're able to not only find new ways to extract, but also we would need a lesser amount. So in some really old cases when products or material was not carefully processed or put away, you'll find that this scenario will come up where if there is DNA, they may not have a lot of it because so many people could have handled it. It could have been destroyed over time and now there's not much left, whatever the scenario is. And ultimately, you know, they could come back and it could be the victim's DNA. It could be someone who handled it at the police department or a tech or something like that. I do think, though, and you can correct me if you know the answer to this, but didn't Othram do the DNA processing to solve the other young woman that was murdered in the Baltimore area?
You mean the one that we know her niece?
Yes.
I don't recall that. I don't recall that. Was that Anne Arundel County?
Yes.
Okay, see, Anne Arundel County is different than Baltimore County. They may have been willing to do it. I can't remember her name now.
Montagna? Was it?
Oh, Grace. Grace has never been. That one's never been solved.
Okay, so it was the other young woman.
Yes, and we have talked to her niece. We did a podcast with her niece.
Yes.
Yeah, I feel bad that I can't remember it. Pam Conyers.
Yes, Pam Conyers. Right. So right. I believe when I went to Othram that I asked the guy who you would have talked to, he's the owner, the CEO.
Right.
I had asked him if they had handled that case because it wasn't too long before I had gone there that they had used genetic DNA in order to track this guy down after they were able to get a DNA profile.
Right.
And I believe that he told me that they were involved in it. And I believe that strongly. And one of the reasons is because I had sent information over to, I believe it was an email that I had sent to the FBI in terms of Joyce's case, mm-hmm. as a suggestion that they also send whatever they're able to collect, or if they can't collect anything, to Othram in order to see if they're able to do anything. And in my email, I mentioned that they had also helped with her case. Right. So I believe that strongly, that they were involved in processing that genetic DNA.
So several of those have been solved. Heather, young girl named Heather, hers was solved. And it turned out to be a neighbor, but it was in Lansdowne, and he already had a record. So he could have been in the little Maskell gang. Pam's was solved, and it was somebody that wasn't connected to anybody that we know about. Grace has not, but according to one person, Edgar says he killed her. So who knows? Edgar was not always, you know, in charge of his faculties either.
Right.
But yeah, it's really unfortunate that they were not able to use those resources. I'm very cynical about that they're even trying.
Sure.
I'm really cynical. How's that?
Well, you know, when you already don't have faith in the department, it's mm-hmm. kind of hard to trust that they have the best judgment in hand. Mm-hmm. You know, like for the FBI, I think I agree with you. I think it's all trying to save face mm-hmm. because they look horrible when we all talk about how they destroyed all her evidence when it was mm-hmm. still an unsolved case.
Right.
So I think, as you mentioned, I think it was just kind of a ploy to show that they were still doing something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I hate that they're jerking the family around.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, the older brother died, the one that we met a couple of years ago, the older one died. And of course, Don died before the Keepers was even released. And Daryl had a heart attack and or a stroke. And I mean, they're really trying to hold it together and they're not really getting much. They're not getting any information.
Right.
Really sad. Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very sad. Mm-hmm. All right. So the next question is also related to Joyce, but they kind of introduced Kathy into it as well. Was it ever investigated whether Joyce was abducted or killed to make Kathy's death appear as the work of a serial killer, thereby diverting suspicion from Father Maskell or his associates?
I don't know that anybody ever took that approach because we don't know what investigation did happen. You know, it's been brought up. I don't know that whoever killed her would have done it for that reason. I do know that the way she was found was the way that our U.S. soldiers were trained to kill the Viet Cong quickly, which is trust hands and feet behind your back and a slit to the throat. And at the time of her death, Maskell could have been, quote, counseling returning soldiers from Vietnam because he was, there are like 15 different branches of the, you know, U.S. military on Fort Meade. And he was connected with the Air National Guard. So I think it would be very easy for him to find somebody that's suffering from PTSD. It's just my theory. And pay them to kill her. And then, you know, that's it. But the question about her boyfriend is going to come up in a minute, so we might as well answer it now. Her boyfriend was cleared immediately because Joyce and her boyfriend had a habit. She would call from the parking lot of the bar. She's not in the bar, parking lot, and let him know she was on her way, like 10 minutes away. And she'd pull up, she'd come into the gate, she'd pull up outside his barracks, She'd hit the horn two times, and he'd be ready. So he is cleared because he was with all his buddies in his barracks, right? And the horn beeped two times, and he went out, and nobody was there. So we don't know if Joyce beeped it, and somebody abducted her at that point, because she was found on the road entering into the base. So we don't know if it was her beeping the horn or if it was her abductor, if they knew what the pattern was. But he was cleared. In fact, he was moved to another base for his own safety. So, you know, a lot of people want to drag other people into this, but he is not suspicious, nor was Russell.
All right. So, Gemma, are the police or the FBI currently investigating Jerry Koob's possible involvement in Kathy's disappearance and murder?
I have no idea. Okay, the FBI would not, I don't think the FBI would be involved because it's Baltimore County Police Department who are investigating Kathy's murder. Now, I can tell you, because this is public information, that numerous allegations of abuse have been made against Koob by a number of women. And in July of, write this down, friends, 2023, an extensive article was written in the Baltimore Banner by Julie Sharper and Justin Fenton. You might recognize Justin's name because he wrote the book, We Own This City, and he investigated the dirty cops in Baltimore City who were doing a lot of illegal stuff and making money off of it. So he and Julie went up to New Jersey unannounced, and Koob let them in, and he talked to them for 2 hours. He defended himself. They had a lot of information ahead of time, and they were able to ask him very pointed questions. If somebody came to your house and said they wanted to talk to you about abuse of minors, I don't know about you, but I'd kick him out and call the police. I wouldn't invite him in and defend myself for 2 hours unless I had something to hide. Just me saying this again. He denied all of it. He said he had letters from several of the women. And I'm thinking, good on them for writing to him and letting him have it. And he said, the letters are vile and disgusting. So I used to have a polite but neutral line of communication with him on Facebook Messenger. But after this article, I couldn't stomach it anymore. So I just cut the ties with him and his daughters. I actually had a little conversation with one of his daughters, and she said she doesn't believe any of it. And I don't know. I think, you know, with your family, it's hard to believe that somebody did something wrong, but he's actually been caught in so many lies, like questions I've asked him and things he said that don't jive with what is. So we know he's capable of that. But I don't know if they're investigating him. The allegations of abuse were reported to our attorney general's office and to our investigator, Richard Wolf. If anybody out there has similar allegations, I'm going to recommend you get in touch with me or Shane, and we can facilitate your connection to the Attorney General's office through their criminal investigator, because it's more than a few, it's a bunch, and they didn't all know each other. We're talking about 3 different states. We're talking about Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. So he's 85. Who knows? Maybe it's easier not to investigate him and just hope he dies soon. But I don't think he's going anywhere. I just hope he doesn't run.
Right.
Disappear to the Virgin Islands or wherever they go.
All right. And Gemma, this will be our last question, and then we will do a follow-up episode with all the other questions, since we have so many. So has Jerry Koob ever exhibited any suspicious behavior since the release of the Keepers, in your opinion?
Well, I think he exhibited suspicious behavior in the Keepers. And we have our behavior analyst, Mike, who's federally trained to look at body language and people's behaviors and actions. And he actually did 3 podcasts with us, right?
Yeah.
Identifying times in the series with timestamps where Coob exhibited odd behaviors. To me, be honest with you, the first time I met him, I felt very sorry for him. He came to my home, and then we went over to Carriage House, and I cried because I felt so brokenhearted for him. And his wife was the sweetest thing. She's passed away. Since then, I've asked him to do a podcast, and he said no, but he did say he would answer questions. So I sent him a bunch of questions, and we picked a day and time for him to answer the questions. And I called him up like at 1 o'clock on a Friday, but I knew enough to know that I better do it exactly at 1, because if it was 5 of 1, he would probably say you're too early and not do it. If it was 5 after 1, he'd probably say it's 5 minutes past, I'm not going to do it. So right at 1, and he picked up the phone immediately and he said, I have all my answers. And he started reading the answers to the questions. And I've printed all those on this page. I'll see if I can find them again and reprint them. It's, I think it's like 12 different questions. And one of them was about the letter. Why did you say it was typed? If it was handwritten, and I showed him the pictures, and he said, that bewilders me. So I don't know what suspicious is, because I'm not like a cop. I mean, sometimes I think I am, but I'm not. And I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think the behavior analyst kind of nailed it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that Jerry is a very unique individual. I know from seeing your prior conversations with him, he always more seems to want to know what you know or what you think. And he normally doesn't provide much more information, or he won't. Normally, he just doesn't answer questions or anything like that. But he always seems to want to know where Gemma is. So that's always been a little suspicious to me.
A little creepy. Yeah. He wanted pictures of us. He asked those of us that went to Keo for pictures, like of our high school graduation pictures, which I thought was really creepy. And he met Chris Centofanti and her husband for lunch. She said she wasn't going to go alone. And when they left, her husband said, well, you're never going to connect with him again. So he thought he was odd. Very narcissistic, in my opinion. I'm saying that because I don't want a defamation suit. In my opinion, he's very narcissistic. It's about him. Like when he met Marilyn at the airport hotel, that's in the Keepers, I was there. And the first thing he said to her was, did you bring the ring? That was the very first thing he said, because he had given Kathy a ring that she wore on a chain around her neck. She didn't wear it on her finger, but when she was found, it was on her left hand, ring finger, and there was a glove on it, on that hand, which takes me to saying that there was a DNA person who was trying to get DNA off of that glove. So I don't know if that was ever successful or not. First thing he said was about the glove. Second thing he said was, I will never forgive your family for the way they treated me when Kathy died. And a couple weeks ago, our friend Ronnie Norpell said to me that her family member that knew him well said that he told her family member that when he came to Baltimore, when Kathy was found, that Mr. Sesnick physically went after him and called him a lion effing bee. And I think that's significant because I do believe that Mr. Sesnick gave the letter to the police. It's in the missing person report, but at one point it says letter, at one point it says envelope. But I do think he gave it to them, and I think he read it. And I think Kathy probably explained what was going on. And so when he meets up with Coob, and again, this is just my theory. He told Ronnie's family member that Sesnick went after him physically. And that would kind of explain a lot. Very odd behavior. But for him to say to Marilyn, after not seeing her for like 50 years, I'll never forgive your family for the way they treated me when Kathy died. And Kathy's family's withdrawn from all this completely. I mean, it was causing health problems. It was just not a healthy situation for them to stay embroiled in all this. And I miss Marilyn terribly, but I understand it. And it's her prerogative to withdraw from all the spotlight and all the attention. So it's just, this whole thing has just really impacted so many people.
Yeah, and we did one of the more recent episodes with, was that Ronnie?
Yes.
Yeah, and so in that episode, she kind of gives an insight into Coop at the time. She remembered meeting Kathy and her brother being in their car with Coop and Kathy. Mm-hmm. So that was a really good episode. So if whoever's listening would like to hear that episode, you'll find it. Well, Jamil, let's go ahead and end this episode here, and we'll pick back up in the next episode. Right.
Shane, can you real quick explain to everybody what you've done with the episodes to make them easier to find?
Yeah. So, of course, our episodes are always a part of Foul Play. So it's always going to be season two. That's where they're all at. But one of the other things I've done here recently is created a separate podcast with only Sister Kathy's episodes in them. And so that podcast is called Who Killed Sister Kathy?
Excellent.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and end there, and we'll pick it back up next time.
Thanks, friends.